Activists demand answers after the shooting deaths of several trans women in Jacksonville, just as a new survey shows many are still experiencing discrimination and harassment. We'll take your calls on this in just a moment. And good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, the concerns of this city's LGBTI community as a new survey documents their experiences. What are your questions, thoughts, comments? Give us a call at 549-2937. Then later, how CanPay, a cashless payment system for medical marijuana, is spreading all across Florida. We'll tell you about that. And good news when it comes to juveniles in the local criminal justice system. A progress report of sorts. That's coming up too. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, a group of activists appeared in front of the Jacksonville City Council last night demanding answers after a fourth trans woman was shot in the city. That's four shootings this year in the transgender community. Three of those women have died, the latest over the weekend. Gina Duncan, director of Transgender Equality at Equality Florida, tells our news partner News for Jax that JSO is misgendering the victims and that is hindering the homicide investigations. Take a listen.
They're actually impeding their own investigations by being out in the community looking, asking questions about a victim who is male and with male pronouns when this person has actually been living their lives authentically as a transgender female.
Now, as that investigation continues, at the same time, the largest survey of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex adults ever conducted in this area is out. And it finds that the majority of people who responded have experienced what they call everyday discrimination, being threatened, disrespected, harassed in a multitude of ways. The data seems to show that despite marriage equality in this country and other major steps forward, we've still got a long way to go. Here with more about this, we welcome Michael Myers, president of the LGBT Community Fund for Northeast Florida. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Cindy Watson, executive director of Jasmine, the area's sexual minority youth network. Good morning to you.
Thank you. Good morning, Melissa.
And four transgender women have been shot in this city over the past year. Three of them have died. This, as a new survey shows, widespread discrimination, despite the passage of our human rights ordinance and other moves forward for Jacksonville and America. So we want your calls and thoughts and questions about this. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or just let us know what you think on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. All right, Michael Myers, let's start with you. How was this study put together and what are the major findings?
Melissa, first, thanks very much for having us this morning. We very much appreciate the opportunity to get the message out about this. So Cindy and I were part of a group that were interested in data because I think we try to run our organizations very much from a data perspective. And when we looked at what was available in Jacksonville, there's a reasonable amount of data available on youth, which we may talk a little bit about, but really not a lot of data about adults. So we decided to put together a study, and we contacted the Williams Institute, which is the leading think tank that looks at gender identity and sexual orientation issues from a policy perspective, and talked with them about putting together a study, which we have now done. We ran it last summer and fall, and then now we have the results of that study.
And let's hear the results. What are people telling you?
Well, the results, it's a comprehensive study, so the results go a lot of ways. I would say one of the key results is that as you opened with, LGBT people continue to feel a lot of discrimination, that it's just a part of the landscape. Another piece of the results was that the LGBT community in Jacksonville is a vibrant and successful and contributing community. And so the biggest picture result to me is that we need to work with our community to make it a more welcoming place for the LGBT community.
And Cindy Watson of Jasmine, the majority of people who responded to this survey, about 75%, say they've experienced threats, harassment, other problems, problems in public places, problems at work. All of this information is coming out at the same time. We're seeing this really worrisome trend of transgender people being shot, and three out of the four that have been shot in the last year have been killed in Jacksonville. And so tie these threads together for us, if you could.
Well, first of all, Melissa, you know, June is LGBT Pride Month around the country. And so here in Jacksonville, we find ourselves, while other people are celebrating LGBT Pride, we are actually grieving and the murders of these trans women of color, and find ourselves in a place that
Of color. Thanks for pointing that out.
Trans women of color, and finding ourselves in a place of needing to, you know, speak out and stand up. And so the survey comes at a really, really important time, because I think it provides some of the answers to questions, or it documents the realities of gender minorities, of trans people's lives, of people of color's lives who are LGBT, you know, as well as the entire community. I do want to say, you know, we've done some work with young people, and we know one of the reasons this study is so important is because we know the numbers of LGBT people are on the rise. Just in terms of high school students, we know that in 2013, when we asked how many identified as LGBT, 9.4% identified. By 2017, that had gone to 16.5%. So we know the numbers of LGBT young people are growing. That means the entire community is growing, and we need to pay attention to this data.
Okay, and we'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Okay, so we've seen the third transgender homicide in just 4 months in Jacksonville, another African-American trans woman. This is getting national attention, and events are coming up to sort of speak out against this or raise awareness about it. Michael, people spoke at city council last night. There's a rally coming up tonight at the Duval County Courthouse. And so can you talk a little bit about how JSO is responding to this? They're trying to find the killers, and they don't see a connection between this latest homicide and another one earlier this month where the woman survived. At the same time, police are being criticized for misgendering these women. And so JSO's policy is to list the victim according to the name they were born with and the gender identity they were born with.
Right. I think that this, what's going on locally, is a reflection, really, of what is happening nationally about are not being up to speed about trans issues. And I think JSO, if they want to fully do their job, needs to get to the latest understandings and studies about the way that they should deal with the transgender community. And I don't think JSO is alone in its in its shortcomings in this area. I think many institutions around the country are behind. But clearly, trans is a part of the life in America today and in our community, and we need to do better than we're doing.
You know, the study really points to different types of discrimination that our LGBT community have experienced. So among all residents, 13.7% reported being unfairly stopped or searched or questioned or threatened by the police. But African-American respondents reported higher numbers of that, and gender minority respondents reported discrimination around job security and being fired from a job. So those are some of the data points, I think, that show or that document what's happening in our city. Melissa, the study has a list of recommendations that I just want to point to, because this is relevant for JSO.
Let's hear those.
The recommendations, the top one is that The community should foster a social environment that embraces residents and creates a safe environment and a welcoming environment. And so one of the suggestions is for city government and the police department to establish liaisons with the LGBT community. That opening of communication and direct line of communication would go a long way to mitigating this particular situation with JSO. I do know that JSO has been communicating with LGBT leaders just in the last 24 hours, and so that's a good sign. I think they do want to you know, get on the right page and work with us, so we are eager to do that. But this study really lays that out.
And from the perspective of the LGBT Community Fund, the reason we did this was so we could figure out from a data perspective what needs to be done. We are making the results available to everyone in the community. And hopefully these results show what we need to do to move forward and do better.
And let's go to your calls right now. Four trans women, all of color, have been shot in the city of Jacksonville this year. A new study is out with data showing that the majority of people in this city who are part of the LGBTI community, and I stands for intersex, we'll talk about that in a minute, the majority of people are reporting discrimination, harassment, threats, problems at work. This despite the passage of our human rights ordinance in Jacksonville after years of debate about that and other steps forward in this country like marriage equality. So give us a call. We want your thoughts and comments and questions as well. So call us up right now at 549-2937. Let's go to Jim on the West Side right now. Hi, Jim. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Melissa, in y'all's intro to this story, you said that there was a gentleman who was living his life as a transgender woman. Now, had you just said living his life as a transgender or living his life as a woman, wouldn't that have been just as easily understood? Why the double, whatever you call it, in describing what he is?
Okay.
I know there's a world of things about that issue. We could talk for the next 30 minutes about what I don't know, but that's my one question this morning, and I appreciate your answer.
Thanks for that. And I think millions of Americans are still trying to understand this community, Cindy, understand new terminology that keeps entering the vocabulary, our vocabulary. Let's talk through some of this.
Well, the vocabulary or the language is evolving in our culture, and, you know, so sometimes we use the word transgender transgender persons. Sometimes we use trans women. Many times when people have fully transitioned, they no longer consider themselves transgendered. They're women, and we respect that. And really, the language should be about each person being able to say, this is how I want to identify, and this is how I want to be called, and this is who I am.
Right. And so at the same time, what would you say to listeners who might appreciate that at a superficial level, but at a deeper level, they're baffled by these acronyms that are new, particularly to older Americans. Intersex is a term that I would guess many Americans have no idea what that means. There's so much education, I think, that needs to go on about sexual minorities in America who are on a continuum of identities. This can be tough for a lot of Americans to grasp and try to come to a place of understanding about.
I totally agree with that. I think, let me just go back to the trans thing first, because I have to say for myself, I have had to learn about it. And in studying it, trans has been a part of life for forever. I mean, if you go back to the shamans and Indian tribes, I mean, it's basically been a part of life forever. The simplest way I would describe trans is people are born with genitals that are asex. And what trans is their identity, what's in their brain, is different than what their sex is. Mm-hmm. And it's a somewhat of a hard concept to get, but I believe it is as true as any of us feel anything. I think trans people feel like, wow, the genitals I have do not match what's in my brain. On intersex, so most babies are born either with male genitalia or female genitalia. There are a very small percentage where those genitals do not are not clearly male or not clearly female. Historically, the practice was that the doctor that birthed the baby would make them one direction or another. I think better practice today is they let the baby, you know, grow up and then figure out what the right answer is.
Okay. And that's a, as you pointed out, that's a minority of a minority. So we're talking about, relative to the huge population of America as a whole, a relatively small group of people, but it's a group, Cindy, that has had made enormous progress in the last decade in educating the public about where they're coming from, working towards full equality and acceptance in American society. I think what's happening in Jacksonville, though, now shows that we've got a long way to go.
We have a long way to go. The study does show some positive things. I mean, it does show that more people are out than ever before, and that when people are out to their family, their friends, their bosses, that kind of thing, they also experience more acceptance. Some of the data about that, like more than a fifth of the respondents in this survey reported that their bosses knew their sexual minorities. So a lot did know their bosses. A lot of their bosses did know their sexual orientation. So, but one of the other pieces about that is that in the African-American community, fewer people were out, especially in the workplace. And that was also true for the gender minority community, for transgender and other gender minorities.
And Melissa, what you said a minute ago was that education. And that really is something that I strongly believe, that essentially, as people get familiar, they get more comfortable. And so we have a lot of work to do. And it continues with the LGB part of our community, but also certainly even more so with the T part of the community.
And we will go back to your calls in a moment at 549-2937 as we talk about this new study and the homicides of transgender women, African-American women in Jacksonville. There have been 4 shootings this year, 3 deaths. What are your thoughts about that and questions? At the same time, here's an email from a listener. It's nothing less than embarrassing and repugnant that so many people, including the police, feel the need to concern themselves with other people's lives and expression. Trump has legitimized hate, and all the restraints are off for closet haters. We've gotten a lot of emails like that over the last several months, by the way. And so here's another one from Rhoda. Why is JSO misgendering these trans women? Why is there not a liaison at the sheriff's office? Now, as you mentioned a minute ago, Cindy, the police are trying to liaise with this community. Have they indicated that they might change their practice of how they identify homicide victims?
Yes,
when they investigate?
In the last 24 hours, we have heard from the sheriff's office. They do want to take a look at their policies and correct this, and they do want to have more communication with the community. So I expect that there will be community meetings, coming up. Sooner is certainly better than later, but we do see a little bit of movement.
And so if the investigation correctly identifies the person's gender identity from the start, is it your contention, Michael, that just a law enforcement agency extending that level of respect and acceptance changes the climate overall? How important is this for the police to make this sort of change? How important do you see that as being?
Well, one, in terms of getting cooperation from the community, I think it clearly is a huge step forward. But from a practical perspective, I mean, if you are dealing, with a homicide in a certain set of facts, and you're basing it off of a set of documents that are inaccurate as to what the facts are.
So the police report would identify the homicide victim as
a male.
With a male name.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it just, okay, so exactly how do you investigate this?
Right.
So part of what happens when there is this you know, lack of policy is that the transgender community and the larger LGBT community operates without accurate information and so reacts in fear, which is completely understandable. People don't know if they're in danger, if their lives are in danger, if their friends' lives are in danger or not. They may also have important information to share that could be helpful to an investigation, but if they don't have any kind of trust of the sheriff's office, they wouldn't come forth with that.
Jeremiah is on the east side. Jeremiah, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning, ma'am.
Go ahead.
I got a comment, right? Because I grew up, you know, where we had a totally different society and everything. And over the years, I've watched as, you know, what was unusual was forced upon people, and it's supposed to be taken as a norm by everybody. What you got to understand is that you can't legislate something and expect people to just accept it, just to swallow. Everybody's going to believe what they're going to believe. Everybody's going to feel how they're going to feel. Just like, you know, with y'all say LGBT and all that stuff, we call it something totally different. You know what I'm saying? Me, myself, I live and let live. You know what I'm saying? There's no way it don't affect me. I live and I let live. But you got people that's always going to hate homosexuals. You got people, you got homosexuals that don't like straight people.
So well, Jeremiah, let me ask you something. Let me ask you something. Yes, you could make the argument that there are always going to be people that hate African Americans. This country legislated a change during the civil rights era that mandated that you had to serve African Americans in restaurants. You had to allow African Americans to vote. You had to give African Americans equal consideration for employment. Marriage between black and white people used to be illegal in this country. Society moves forward is the point I'm trying to make to you. And you're right that there are people that will always have hate in their hearts, but that doesn't mean that that discrimination against them should be enshrined in law.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is this right here, right? I'm what you termed African American. I don't put that designation on myself because I feel like it's incorrect. But, you know what I'm saying, just to go along with what you're saying, I'm African American. You understand what I'm saying? But I know that there are still people all over this country that do not like African Americans. You can go to Alabama and there's people up there, it's Caucasians up there. You understand what I'm saying? They still wear their white robes and stuff, and they will lynch you. If they can get away with it, they'll kill you. And they will tell you that.
Right. And I think everyone recognizes that, Jeremiah. And so let's let the guests here respond. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think that, you know, hate exists and probably always will exist, unfortunately. But what I think we are talking about is each of us trying to make it better, trying to make our community a more embracing and inclusive community for all of us who live here. And I think that's just the simple way I would say it.
And I do think we really celebrated when Jacksonville passed a city ordinance to ban discrimination against the LGBTQ community a little over a year ago. But I do not think we've realized the full promise of that ordinance because our institutions, the city government, the JSO, the health department, I mean, there are several places where we haven't fully implemented those policies, and that's where the work needs to be.
Let's go to James in Ponte Vedra. Hi, James. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, James. Go ahead, James.
Well, I just wanted to say there are currently many issues facing LGBTQ people across this country, but especially in Florida. I live in Ponte Vedra, where it's a much more, I would say, St. Johns County is much more conservative than Duval County on many areas, but Duval County is still pretty conservative as well. And unfortunately, as a result, in St. Johns County, we still have discrimination allowed on the legislative level. And even, you know, even on the legislative level, to me, seems something very basic. And if we can't get to something so basic in some counties in Florida, then acceptance will definitely be very hard to strive towards. But like you said, I believe education is very important. And, you know, the previous person on the line, I couldn't fully understand what he was saying, but it sounded like he was justifying hate crimes or justifying hate, and that just does not seem acceptable. All we can do is fight, but we definitely do have a long way to go. And as a gay man personally, all I can say is, yeah, it's going to take a long time. And I mean, you can look around the globe, we're in over 70 countries. Homosexuality between two men is outlawed. Like in Saudi Arabia, if two gay men have sexual intercourse, they will get stoned to death.
Right. Thanks, James, for that. And so let's end with this. This study, I think, you know, Michael, provides impetus for an ongoing push, I think, at the statewide level for an anti-discrimination protection measure, right?
Yes, it definitely does. I mean, there have been there's been efforts over the last few years that get traction and then don't to do a non-employment discrimination a statewide bill, and you know that those efforts need to keep going. In Jacksonville, our efforts to really make the community more inclusive and to get policies from everything from public agencies to businesses to make a more level playing field for our LGBT brethren.
We'll follow that. In the meantime, thanks to Michael Myers, president of the LGBT Community Fund for Northeast Florida, Cindy Watson, who heads Jasmine. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Bye-bye.
Much more still ahead later. Finally, some good news for juvenile justice reform in the city. We'll tell you how police and prosecutors are working together to keep more kids out of that school-to-prison pipeline, as it's called. But up next, are you in the market for some medical marijuana? Well, the new cashless payment system, CanPay, is ready for you right here in Florida. We'll tell you about it next.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
He was 39 and I was 15. He was black, I was brown. And he was a convicted cop killer. I was the president of Chess Club.
Join us for more true stories told live. This week, stories about self-defense, sled dogs, and death row. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Next time on Jazz Night in America, East meets West, and the West meets the East. Tabla master Zakir Hussain and bass legend Dave Holland share with us Cross Currents, a world of ideas flowing between India and America. I'm Christian McBride.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, Florida has become the first state in the nation to see 100% adoption of a cashless payment offering for the Sunshine State's rapidly growing medical marijuana market. Now, this system is called CanPay. The company bills itself as a banking solution for both cannabis dispensaries and customers alike. So how does this work? I learned more about CanPay and the growing cannabis market in Florida with the company's CEO, Dustin Eady. Take a listen.
Okay, so Florida is apparently the first state to have widespread adoption of this cashless payment solution for the growing medical marijuana market. How does your company, CanPay, work? How does this business model work?
Sure. So you're correct that this is the first state. There's 100% adoption of CanPay in the dispensaries in the state of Florida. which means that any one of the, I guess the number is now 125,000 patients that signs up for CanPay to use it can pay at any dispensary that they shop at with CanPay. So it's the first market that has 100% adoption of a payment method built for the cannabis industry. CanPay works on the ACH or Automated Clearinghouse network instead of the Visa or MasterCard services. Those card brands have prohibited transactions on their network. So we used a banking network of compliant financial institutions to build our own debit network that allows a patient to download the CanPay app from canpayapp.com, set up their account, and link it directly to their checking account at any U.S. institution. And then when they go into the dispensary or for delivery, in the case of the Florida market, they can pay using CanPay, and that money will transfer from their checking account to the dispensary's checking account, similar to any other debit card that they might use.
And can you explain a little bit about why this sort of workaround is needed for people buying cannabis in Florida?
Yeah, absolutely. There's still conflict between the federal laws around marijuana regulation and the state laws in those states that have enabled legislation or passed legislation to allow for a medical or adult use recreational cannabis market. And so with that uncertainty comes uncertainty for financial institutions. In 2014, the Department of Treasury Financial Crimes Enforcement Network released guidance for financial institutions that did choose to bank the cannabis industry in their local state markets. And so there is guidance at the federal level on how to bank this industry, how to provide financial services to the industry. But it's very complicated and requires a lot of what is termed enhanced due diligence and on-site visitation by the financial institutions, reporting to the federal government on the clients, the cannabis licensees that they work with. And so it's very complicated. There aren't a lot of institutions that are actively banking the cannabis industry. In fact, a lot of the news that you read is about companies losing their bank accounts with their institutions because most of the large institutions are not participating in any way in the cannabis industry or the marijuana industry. This also is true for the financial service providers like Visa, MasterCard, and the other major credit card brands. They have prohibitions on cannabis transactions through their networks. And so we needed to build something that was going to be compliant with that federal guidance and not violate anyone's prohibitions on their technology or their networks.
And it appears that here in Florida, we're talking about several dozen dispensaries now where this is available. The dominant players seem to be Trulieve and Surterra, but there are others, too, across the state. And so CanPay then will have a presence in all corners of the Sunshine State, it sounds like.
That's correct. So I believe we're at about 42 dispensaries that are open in the market right now, with more coming online all the time, including new licensees as part of the most recent wave of issuing of licenses. Also, CanPay can be accepted by the dispensary groups, by the licensees, for delivery payments. And so many customers that aren't necessarily served or patients that aren't necessarily served right now by a local dispensary are receiving their medicine via home delivery. Those patients can use CanPay to pay at the time of delivery, like any patient would in a dispensary as well.
And the cannabis industry is expected to reach into the billions by 2020. How is this affecting your business model as you scale up around the country, Dustin?
Yeah, so we are currently serving patients and consumers in 15 states, with several more states coming online in the probably next couple of weeks to a month. And so we are expanding with a rapidly expanding cannabis industry. And that's very exciting for us. To Florida, when the rules changed that allowed more patients to participate in the medical marijuana program here in Florida, and the numbers went from 40,000 to 100,000 very rapidly. That obviously had a big impact for CanPay. There's a very large user base of patients that have signed up and regularly use CanPay when they purchase their medicine. And now that we're at 100% adoption within the dispensaries that they're accepting CanPay, we think that's going to accelerate even faster, because now patients, whoever they purchase from, wherever they go, they're going to be able to use that CanPay account to make their purchases in a cashless manner. It's free for them to use. It's highly secure, and it allows them to make purchases without having to go get cash from an ATM, pay fees, or carry all that cash around. And we know that carrying cash can be unsafe.
And you can learn more at canpaydebit.com. Dustin Eady, CEO of CanPay, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And still ahead, why Duval is finally making some progress in keeping more young people out of the criminal justice system. That's next.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for the Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
The images this week have been striking. Young kids being ripped away from their parents at the border. It's a part of President Trump's zero-tolerance immigration crackdown. This week, we untangle what this means. Why are families being separated? Where are the kids taken? When will these children be reunited with their parents? On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Saturday at 3 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, for years, juvenile justice advocates around the country and even the world have harshly criticized Duval County for arresting dozens of kids every month for sometimes very minor infractions. Now, these are kids who could have stayed out of the system altogether if they'd been offered an alternative, a way to keep them out of what's known as the school-to-prison pipeline that can ruin young people's lives. So, here's the news. After years of criticism and scrutiny over this, a new report shows that Duval County is making some progress. There's been a big increase in the alternative that's called a civil citation that's issued to minors in this area's judicial circuit. Tessa Duval, reporter with the Florida Times Union, has been covering this, and she's here with more. Hi, Tessa. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
And we want your calls on this at 549-2937. And so for years, the former state attorney, Angela Corey, was excoriated for not issuing enough of these civil citations. The local interfaith group ICARE for years would apply pressure to the prosecutor's office, the police, saying, you've got to look at this. Now, with a new sheriff and a new state attorney, Melissa Nelson, it appears that all of that activism is bearing fruit. What do the numbers show?
So people in Northeast Florida are so encouraged because this isn't just Jacksonville. It's also Nassau and Clay counties, because the state attorney is over three counties. And so therefore, when Ms. Corey had a policy that, for example, misdemeanor battery couldn't receive a civil citation, which is what a lot of fights are, when that was a policy, it prevented a lot of children in these three counties from getting civil citations that law enforcement or school police would have otherwise liked to have given. And so now, with this new state attorney and a new policy in place for a little more than a year now, the state attorney has essentially removed itself from the process. And so what we're seeing in 2017, the numbers are up significantly over 2016. But what I think is really exciting is in the first quarter of 2018, which is really about all the data that we have from the state so far, is that Duval County is around 90% of eligible kids who are committing misdemeanor offenses who are getting civil citations. Mm-hmm. That means that these kids would have otherwise been arrested, had to go to court, you know, miss school, their parents would miss work, they'd have a record. And now they're not having any of that because they're getting this alternative, which still holds them accountable, but doesn't require an arrest and everything that comes with that.
Right. 90% now of the time, law enforcement agencies are issuing a civil citation to a minor instead of making an arrest, you report. These are for infractions like fighting, drug and alcohol offenses, essentially misdemeanors.
Yes.
And so this is something you could argue that Melissa Nelson, the current state attorney, ousted Angela Corey in part over this very issue. She pledged a different approach.
Absolutely. This was for Melissa Nelson a campaign promise that she was going to be different from Angela Corey on issues of juvenile justice. And this is one of the biggest ones because civil citations are favored nearly, I mean, across the board, across the political spectrum. People who tend to lean more libertarian, conservative, like the James Madison Institute, for example, are very in favor of this because they save taxpayer dollars. They promote good outcomes from kids. You know, people who tend to be more left of center and criminal reform, criminal justice reform advocates also really support these because of the outcomes. So this was something that she was getting attacked on, that Ms. Corey was getting attacked on from both sides. And so when Melissa Nelson took office and essentially removed the state attorney's office from the process, before the state attorney would look at all of these civil citations and was kind of they had to all pass through that office. So now that doesn't happen. So an officer can directly issue a civil citation to a child. And, you know, kudos to JSO because they have made this their policy. They looked at it for a time and thought, we'll see how this works. Now the department, I mean, they're all in. They're big believers in it. Only 6 kids year to date, according to JSO stats, have not gotten a civil citation. And, you know, either the child has to refuse or a supervisory officer has to agree that arrest is better. So by taking the state attorney out of the process, it really lets law enforcement use their discretion and address the situation at hand. And what we're seeing is they're favoring this. That's why the numbers are so high.
And what are your questions about the school-to-prison pipeline and progress on how we treat juveniles here in Duval? Your calls after the break. It's 549-2937 as we continue talking about this with Tessa Duval of the Florida Times Union. Civil citations. What are your questions about civil citations? Do you agree or disagree with police and prosecutors really increasing this? And what about the fact that this new policy is eliminating racial disparities in the way juveniles of color have typically been treated in this city for many decades? So we're going to take a quick break and then continue our discussion with Tessa of the Florida Times Union and your calls at 549-2937.
A novel in verse.
I spend part of my paycheck on union dues for dignity and part on war bonds to help Papa and Nico fight for liberty.
Margarita Engel, the Young People's Poet Laureate and first Latina to receive the honor, looks back at anti-immigrant sentiment during the Second World War. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Thank you.
President Trump says the U.S. needs new laws to cut down on illegal immigration.
We want a system where when people come in illegally, they have to go out.
Illegal border crossings are actually down since 2000, but asylum cases are up. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A look at what those numbers tell us about what's to come this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, W. Kamau Bell returns. He has a new Netflix stand-up comedy special called Private School Negro. His CNN series, United Shades of America, is in its third season. And he has a new web miniseries about investigating his ancestry and turning up some big surprises, including one about his white great-great-grandfather. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The president's aggressive trade policy is at the center of his economic approach. Key to his argument is leveling the playing field. But there are early signs that tariffs are not working as planned. Harley Davidson says it's moving some production out of the U.S. Could Mr. Trump's plan backfire? We'll talk to former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
And we're back with your calls about the increased use of civil citations for juveniles in Duval County. Chloe is on the south side. Hi, Chloe. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. I love everything I'm hearing so far. I think it's super important that they would have a program that addresses not only the racial issue, but just helping in general for kids to stay out of the system. But I have always felt like there should be another prong to the approach that addresses the families, the parents, because that's where it all starts. Is there some sort of education or program for parents of at-risk children on how they can help their children, some training for them? Is that part of the program? Could it be part of the program?
Sure, like how pretrial diversion works. Yeah, I got you, Chloe. Tessa, thanks for the call, Chloe.
So what's important to know about civil citation is these are kids who are doing really minor things. They're getting caught with beer, you know, they're stealing phone chargers from Target, that kind of thing. So when a child receives a civil citation, their parent, you know, becomes a part of the process. So if a child goes to a neighborhood accountability board, their parent needs to be there with them. But what's important to note is because these are such minor offenses, a lot of these kids wouldn't reoffend in the first place. This is a way to hold them accountable, but there are kids who will go on deeper into the system. And that's really where parent involvement and parent education becomes a lot more important.
And preventing a juvenile from getting a conviction or a charge on his record is so important in so many ways, because once that's on their record, it can affect the entire future trajectory of their life. Let's go to Barbara at the beaches. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much. I really am glad to hear that the civil citations are being used more. I think it's important to hold the offender accountable and not just let him go or her go. But I also wondered whether there's any component to this that includes drug treatment and mental health counseling.
Sure.
So thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
So absolutely. Neighborhood accountability boards can, and when children receive civil citations, one of the ways that it can be handled is to go to a neighborhood accountability board. And so kids are assessed when they receive these civil citations. And so that can be part of their sanction to get mental health counseling, to get drug treatment. But it's also worth noting there is a separate juvenile drug court available for local children as well.
You also report, Tessa, that a new law goes into effect Sunday statewide, and it requires all 20 of Florida's judicial circuits to use civil citations for kids. This is part of a national smart justice reform movement that's taken hold across the country that really does, as you pointed out, have bipartisan support.
Absolutely. I mean, better outcomes, it saves money, it saves time. You know, one thing that's worth pointing out is part of the reason that JSO became such a big believer in civil citations is because it resulted in officers getting back on the streets faster. You know, to arrest a child takes a lot longer than arresting an adult because, you know, a child has to go to the juvenile assessment center. There's all this time spent waiting. You got to contact parents. Whereas if you can just give a civil citation, that allows the officer to spend more time, you know, on the street in the community as opposed to waiting around for this process. So, I mean, really, there's just with the proven outcomes, there's a recidivism rate of 4% statewide. 4% of these kids will reoffend within the first 12 months after this, with the cost savings from, you know, officers not having to spend time waiting around, from not processing these kids through courts. It's just very difficult for folks to argue with this.
Mm-hmm. And you can learn more about this if you pick up a copy of today's Times Union or read Tess's work online at jacksonville.com. By the way, subscribe to the Times Union if you haven't already.
Yes,
Tessa
please.
Duval of the Florida Times Union, always good to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Our show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. Next on 1A, as the Supreme Court upholds President Trump's Muslim travel ban, the show asks, are narrow rulings the Supreme Court's new normal? That discussion is coming up in just a moment. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be back again tomorrow with a look at those Supreme Court rulings that the High Court is issuing. They always come out with them in June. And we're going to tell you not only about the travel ban tomorrow, but also an important Florida ruling that will impact so many listeners. That's coming up tomorrow. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8, just keep listening for the Electro Lounge and some great chill out music. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.